Blog Talk Radio.
Come on, there it goes. Crank up the band.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, May 11th, 2017. This is Michael Norris along with Bobby Simmons, Jerry Oates, and Jay West. The full battalion is on the march for the first time in a while. How are you guys doing this evening?
All right.
Doing well.
You just like a mole on Marilyn Monroe's face. You're just happy to be here, huh?
That's it. Huh?
Oh. Well, since the last time we have been on the air, we've lost a few people. I found out after we did last Thursday's show, or actually I found out the same day. I just forgot, didn't get a chance to mention on the air last night or last week. A former guest of ours, Smokey Galento, passed away last Monday, the first. And just yesterday or day before, Hans Schroeder passed away.
You guys usually Dave Meltzer mentions that in the Observer, but he said he is behind because of the time that he spent out there with Bobby having a good time in Las Vegas. So I'm sure here the Wrestling Observer will have information on both of those guys next week.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Because I didn't know anything about either one of them.
I don't know about Smokey. He may not even know Smokey. She was Mario Galento's widow, and she did our show. Lord, I guess it's been 3-4 years ago. Talk about all the people she pulled a gun on to protect Mario.
Jeez.
Oh man.
Yeah, she was more dangerous than he was.
And somebody else, he was not a wrestler, but he was probably the dean of wrestling historians, J. Michael Kenyon, whose real name was Grover or something. Anyway, he's best known as J. Michael Kenyon. He was former radio sports announcer, newspaper columnist, did all kind of stuff, and has been a wrestling historian. Lord, I couldn't, going back, I don't know how far, and most of the guys that, like Scott Teal and Kip Bowman and people like that that have written books about different stuff, J. Michael was, one of their biggest sources and been a big help. But I never met the guy. He used to come to Cauliflower Alley, Bob. Did you ever run across him?
Yeah, I never was close to him, but I did have a chance to meet him.
He was also a childhood friend of Dean Silverstone. They both grew up in Seattle. So, but anyway, he was, around for a long time, and he was 83 years old, and he's been in congestive heart failure for the last several years. But what a character this guy was. I mean, even if he'd never had anything to do, period, with the wrestling business, he would have fit right in because of some of the crazy stuff he did, in his other life. But
his name was well known, in the wrestling circles.
Yeah, I'm sure Dave will do something about on him. And the J, if you put a period after the J in J. Michael Kenyon, he'd yell at you because he said it was just J. And that, like I said, that wasn't his real name. He just made that up.
Right.
He had been a newspaper columnist under his real name, Glover. I think that was his name, Michael Glover. For years in Seattle, and then he left there and went to Baltimore. And I'm just trying to go by memory of stuff I've read on him this past week, so I may get some of the facts wrong. But he went out there, and it was, and when he went back to Seattle, he decided to change his name. He just picked it out of the air and added the J to make it sound more distinguished. So,
well, these were the days before the internet. The internet, you know, and it was a way sometimes to have a life, you know, away from what you did for a living. Because if people knew you by your name and, you know, byline, or the name that you used on the air, then you know, your name would be in the phone book, and you'd constantly be bugging. So that was one of the ways to keep that from happening, was by having a pseudonym. Of course, you'd look for one that was, you know, nice sounding or easy to remember. You know, once you became fairly well known with that name, you had to pretty well stick with it, because if you went to something else, you know, you pretty well lost your background. As of today, with the internet and everything, everybody knows about everybody, it really doesn't make much difference.
What name did you use for your on-air personality?
Well, my giving away the secrets here, at 70 years of age, as of yesterday.
happy birthday to you, and happy birthday to Bobby. Jerry, you and I are the only ones that didn't have a birthday this week, so I guess we're the kids now, and they're the adults.
My real name is Claude Jeffrey West, and Claude was during the Army. My father's buddy in the Army was named Claude Durham, and then Daddy's name was James West, but he went by Jimmy. So they both said, if we get out of here, which they were in the Philippines, they were both already married. He said, I'll name my son after yours, and you name your son after me. And so that's how that came about. The Jeffrey is a very extended version. It's not the normal way you would spell it, and it's not the English G. I won't go into all the details, but anyway, it's part of my maternal grandfather's name. And so, you know, I didn't think either one of them were specifically great. And even before I got into radio, when I was working in a band in high school, you know, other than at the high school where everybody knew my real name, I started using the name Jay West. And it stuck, you know, and there's enough of a continuation of my real name there that I'm really not taking it far. However, I will say that when I filled out my security clearance paperwork when I went to work for the Army, I had to list Jay West as a pseudonym because they wanted to know all the names that you used other than your real name.
Right.
And then they check you out to see if you're some kind of you know, an espionage person.
Just think if Don Fargo had to fill out one of those, all the pseudonyms he'd have to use. Of course, he couldn't write, so the only thing he learned to sign autograph-wise was the Don Fargo part. When I had him autograph my Gulf Coast belt that he actually made, and he and Frank both held together, I had to tell him how to spell Jack Dalton, because that was the name he was using when he held it.
Wow.
But anyway,
that's a good piece of trivia right there, Mike.
Yeah. What? As far
this ain't got nothing to do with the wrestling business, but since we're talking about names, I'll give you a little better story than that. My wife, whose name was Deborah Irene Hester, we were talking one time about how we got our names. I wasn't named after anybody. My name just something my mom pulled up that liked. But my wife, her grandfather fought in World War II. And when he was in France, he had an affair with a French lady who became pregnant.
As you would do if you're in France.
And had a set of twins. Well, when he came home, he felt so guilty about it that he confessed to Debbie's grandmother, who for her, for the time, was a very forward-thinking woman, and said, hey, if she brought you comfort while you were in combat and in war, you know, I forgive you, blah, 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 blah. Long story short, Debbie was named for the woman he had the affair with in France. Thus, the D-E-B-I spelling Debbie used for her name, because that's the way the lady spelled it in France.
Wow.
So it was interesting story. She didn't tell many people that, and I've never told anybody, and now I'm telling the world, but that
wow.
was how Debbie got her name.
That's very interesting.
Well, I got one too. My great grandfather, his name was General Clinton Byrd. That was his given name, but the general was spelled with a J. Don't ask me why. I have no clue. Of course, my grandmother's name, before she married my grandfather, her name was Looney Byrd. L-U-N-N-I-E. Looney Elizabeth Byrd. I used to kid her all the time. I said, you married the first person to ask you, didn't you? Just so you wouldn't spend the rest of your life as Looney Byrd. She failed to see the humor in that.
Yeah, that'd be what they call today a case for bullying in school. with a name like that.
My family has a ton of oddly named folks. Especially as you go back the generations, you know, three or four generations ahead of me. My great grandmother, who was married to General Clinton, her name was Niecy May. And he was 6'8". And she was about 4'8", 4'9", something like that. There was I don't remember him. He died after I was around when he was still alive, but I don't really remember him. I remember my as I called her, Mama Bird. I remember her quite well. But they had a picture made on their 50th wedding anniversary, standing side by side, and she's about height of his hip pocket. So I'm saying you've ever seen.
6'8", he could have been a pro wrestler, you know.
He was some skin and bones, though. But
I guess
he could have, because he was a mean drunk. I'll tell you that. All the birds were. That's why I never drank. I was afraid I'd fall into that category. But anyway, we will be joined at some point this evening, probably in about 2-3 more minutes, because I told him to give us a call about 8:15. Kurt Nielsen is going to join us. No relation to Art Nielsen, as far as I know. But Kurt is, Lord, Kurt's done a little bit of everything. He works for Walt Disney. He's built websites when Percy Pringle was still alive. He built Percy's website. He's done the Cauliflower Alley website. And I don't know if I've got a copy of it around here. He did something. I don't remember the circumstances behind it. I'll get him to tell us. He did a video, an animated video of a wrestling match. And the referee was our dear friend Charlie Smith. And Charlie did the voiceover for it.
I've seen that.
The funniest thing in the world, Charlie, who is a living cartoon anyway, to see him animated, and you can't hide that voice.
No.
Before we get too carried away, guys, I can't remember if I've done this show since all of this happened with me or not. I got tons of calls and cards and letters when my mom passed away.
Oh my God! I didn't know, Bobby.
And I didn't know if I've had a chance to thank everybody or just express. I got emails. I mean, it was just, you know, people found out, and I just want to thank everybody. It's been a tough time. I'm 62 years old, and I miss her dearly, and I just want to thank everybody. I don't want to get too mushy or sentimental, but I appreciate everybody that reached out and shared a thought or a kind word. It helped a lot. So that's enough. I just wanted to thank everybody.
All right. Well, yeah, Miss Margaret was a saint. She not only put up with Bobby, she liked Rocket Monroe of all people.
Yeah, she did. I never figured that out.
Lovable guy. But anyway, let me get Kurt on here with us. Well, where did he go?
I'm here. Hello.
Okay. Hey, Kurt. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. This is Michael, along with Bobby Simmons, Jay West, and Jerry Oates. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine. I just got home from work and just cracked open a beer and let the good times roll,
okay.
Right?
You're doing better than all of us, man. It was just talking about the animated video that you did, and I don't remember the background on that, why you did that, where you used Charlie Smith's voice for the referee.
Oh, sure. Well, that was a pilot for a TV series that I tried to pitch, and it was a little bit, I think, a little bit too soon. I think if I had tried that a few years later, it might have gelled a little bit better because, WWE at this point is now doing animated cartoons and so forth.
Sure.
A lot of things, you know, just for streaming purposes. And but I think, yeah, it was just a little too soon. There wasn't quite the market for it yet.
Kurt, this is Jay West. When did you do it?
Let me see. This would have been 2001, 2002, right around that time.
And just run across Charlie and get the idea to use his voice for the cartoon?
Well, of course, I met Charlie through Cauliflower Alley Club and the Gulf Coast Wrestlers Reunion. Of course, I used Charlie. I used Percy Pringle, Playboy Buddy Rose, Ed Wiskowski, and Les Thatcher as well. And the concept behind it was to use guys who still had personality and something to offer, entertainment-wise, but just in a different context. And it could still work, but, you know, unfortunately, most of the guys that I just listed aren't with us any longer. So so there's a few that have gone away. Buddy Rose and Percy, of course, are gone now. So,
hey, Kurt, this is Bobby. Those of us that saw it, we were scared because if you deal with Charlie on a daily basis, we thought it was a horror film.
Well, Charlie is something special.
I know he's listening. That's why I said that.
No, I love Charlie. Well, and again, Charlie's one of those guys with just really unique talents. And, you can't
just
take him.
Yeah, unique is a good word for him.
But, yeah, you know, someone like me who does animation, who draws cartoons, you hear that voice, and you got to do something with it. You know, you can't just leave it be. Charlie's a great guy. I'm really glad that he was part of that. And who knows, maybe something else will come up down the line. He's still a young man, after all.
That's true.
No, but it's good fun. As I said, it just came a little too early, but I'd be happy to kick it off. But, yeah, the two leads in that, unfortunately, they're gone now, as I mentioned, Buddy Rose and Percy Pringle. But, you know, we can take it in different directions. At least we still got Charlie, right?
That's right. We got Charlie.
Yeah.
We'll get Jerry to do a voiceover on one of them.
Hey, that would be nice. That would be nice, but it was nice to run into a few of the guys at Cauliflower Alley Club. I was with Ed Wiskowski, and I was kind of watching over him a little bit because he's having a few health issues right now, but... anyway, I couldn't go to the banquet. I was kind of running around doing this and that, but it was nice to see a few of you guys at least.
Well, let me ask you, how did you get involved with, like I said, you've been to the reunions and everything. Have you, did
sure.
you ever do anything inside the wrestling industry itself as far
well,
as?
Well, I did. I started with All Pro Wrestling in Northern California with Roland Alexander, and I just, you know, this was in the late 90s. I was volunteering just to get into the business. I did anything. You know, I helped them set up rings. I helped in the office. I ran errands for them, whatever they wanted to do. And they saw my my loyalty and my dedication, and so they asked me to become a cameraman for them. And so I did that for a long, long time. I worked the gimmick tables. I was in charge of bringing the gimmicks to the shows. And then they said, well, we
no
want
wonder
to accelerate
you get
along
with Charlie Smith.
Well, there you go. There you go. But yeah, they, but because I was working so hard and being so loyal, and because I knew so much of the business and respected it, they decided to train me for free to work as in managerial role. All the while, I was working with Roland in the office. And, you know, I was his right-hand man for, you know, a long time in many regards. But, yeah, I was trained to work, and so I learned, you know, pretty much everything about the business that way.
Is he still operating?
Yeah. The All Pro Wrestling is. Roland passed away, I want to say, about 3 years ago now.
That's right, he did pass away. I forgot about that. If I'm not mistaken, because there was a documentary that I saw somewhere along the line, and he was featured in it quite a bit. He's
absolutely,
the one
yeah,
that
I was,
trained John Cena, right? Where Cena
John
got his
Cena.
Start, where he was the prototype or something like that?
Well, John Cena was based out of Southern California. I know Matt Hyson, who became Spike Dudley, came from our group. Vic Grimes, Aaron O'Grady, who became Crash Holly. They trained, he became the Giant Singh in WWE. Unfortunately that led to, I don't know if you remember this or not, but, during training, he actually ended up killing a guy with repeated choke slams. And, there was a lawsuit.
Hearing about it, yeah.
It was pretty bad. And that lawsuit levied against Roland, basically destroyed Roland's life, but of course it doesn't bring back the life of the person that, you know, actually died in the ring. It's a horrible thing. But
and Kurt also
you know,
has
I,
the.
Yep.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm fine.
I was going to say Kurt is also the has the distinction of being the biggest fan in the world of one Plowboy Frazier.
Yeah,
many of us have fond memories of one way or another. But
of course,
in fact, your screen name for a lot of years was Plowboy or Plowboy Nielsen.
Oh, it still is. It still is.
And yeah. I know one time you had a website, Uncle Elber's Cabin. Is that still operating?
It's PlowboyFrazier.com now, but it's been that way for a little while. I haven't updated it in a while, but. It's just because I have so many things going on in my life, but it's still a big part of my life. In fact, just recently, I got an autographed picture of Uncle Elmer. He signed it as Uncle Elmer. All the years that I've been going around, I haven't actually been able to find one. It cost me $100, too, by the way. So, but
Kurt has been to Stan's grave in Biloxi.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, Stan was in the Korean War. Now, the interesting thing about that was he was underage. He was 16 years old when he enlisted, but he was so big he looked like a man. But because of his service there, that is what sustained him in later life when his health really started to give out on him. And he was living in the VA hospital, of course. But thank goodness for that, you know, obviously being a wrestler.
Sure.
Yeah, he wouldn't have had any other health benefits. Certainly for his size with all of his, you know, numerous physical ailments, no one would have taken him. So.
very true. But the amazing thing about him is, of course, me having grown up in Mobile, and he was, you know, a fairly local guy, being from Pascagoula.
Oh, yeah.
That, yep. That, you know, but even then, he wasn't in the territory all the time. They would bring him in for special, kind of like they did Andre later on.
Of course.
And he did all of his, I mean, he was Big Ed Younger in Louisiana there in like 66. He was the convict in 67 and 68 in the Mobile area. And he was, when he first started, you know, working up on the Mobile Dothan end, without, instead of being the convict, he was just called Big Tiny.
Yep.
And in fact, he would work in Mississippi as the convict and then go to Dothan, and he was Big Tiny all at the same time. But but he worked in Omaha for the Dusiks out there.
Oh, yeah.
He worked in California.
Absolutely.
as the convict. I think that's where he started that gimmick.
Yes, absolutely.
I know
he worked in the Pacific. He worked in the Pacific Northwest for Dean Silverstone as well. Yeah, he was really, you know, sort of a, well, I wouldn't say a classic journeyman, but he was, I guess, more like Man Mountain Mike would have been, you know, during that time period. But the difference was he kept changing his identities, mostly because of his personality and his. You know, he had an ability to portray different characters that a lot of guys, a lot of his contemporaries didn't have, you know, and it was unique.
Kurt, this is Jay West. How did you decide that you wanted to do a book on Stan?
Well, you know, he's one of those guys that, you know, here we are talking about him. He left an impression on a lot of people, good or bad. But he's one of those figures from another era that will vanish in time if it's not cataloged. I just felt that he was too important to the industry in his own way to not document his achievements. You know, that's not to say that he was great in the ring. He certainly wasn't, but he was a good draw. And a captivating personality, an interesting personality, and you know, inside and outside of the ring, people always have really remarkable, sort of over the top stories about him that really deserve to be chronicled. So might as well be me. Yeah.
Right. Jerry, did you ever work with Stan?
Never worked with him, no.
See, that's who you should have teamed with instead of the McGuire twins. or you could have had him in there, too. I have all of them in there.
Yeah, that would have done it.
Kurt, you mentioned Man Mountain Mike. They had a battle royal in Mobile in 1973 that had Stan and Man Mountain Mike both in it.
Oh, my gosh.
Of course, they were the first two out because everybody jumped on them and threw them out first.
Of course. Well, you know, the thing about Stan is he could actually work a little bit. Not a lot, but just a little bit. If you watch some of his older matches in particular, he would do more than the typical big man spots. I saw one match from about 1980, so this would be, what, Southeastern Championship Wrestling?
Yeah.
And he did
he did a sort of
it's hard to describe it, but sort of like a rolling suplex. Yeah, and I've never seen him in any other time in his career do anything than the typical big man moves. But he could wrestle. It's just that he was lazy. He didn't have to do anything more than that, you know.
Right.
But I would certainly place him, you know, a lot of people lump him in with the McGuire twins and, you know, and other just big fat guys of that time period. But, you know, he lasted for 30 years. I mean, there had to be more than that. For him to have a sustained career like that.
Yeah, with him being a local, I remember him not only from wrestling, but he was the bouncer / entertainment at a place called the Red Barn, just across the Mississippi state line from going from Mobile into Mississippi.
Oh, man.
And was a great singer, too.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the things that his wife has mentioned to me, that he wanted to record an album, and at one point he had some songs that were recorded live, and I never tracked it down. I couldn't find the guy, but that was something he really wanted to do. He did have a good voice, and the only evidence that people have of that is from the wedding of Uncle Elmer, when he sang to his wife.
Yeah.
But he did a good job on that.
Yeah, it was nothing to go over there to the Red Barn, which I used to do occasionally, even though I was way underage.
Yeah.
but I used to, you know, I don't know if they ever paid him to do that. He was the bouncer, or the doorman, mm-hmm. But he'd grab a guitar and go sit on the stage and start singing, and he was a very well liked guy. There was another place there that he worked as well. It was called the State Line. It was
mm-hmm.
That was literally on the state line. That was the reason they called it that. But he was a big favorite in and around the Gulf Coast territory. And how they used him was, you know, he would come in, you know, kind of like they did with Andre later on.
Sure.
You know, the heels, you know, would get out of hand, and, you know, the top baby face would bring him in to be his tag team partner or whatever. But he spent more time, I think, in Tennessee than anywhere between Memphis and the Nashville end when Gulas was operating.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and it's because his personality fit in with sort of the weird structure of Memphis. Memphis was kind of a cartoon to begin with in many regards. I mean, anything goes in Memphis. And as you know, he played multiple characters and everybody knew it was him at the same time, but it didn't really matter. You know, it helps that Jerry Lawler was really keen on him. They were really good friends, and he probably gave him more of an extended run just based on their friendship. But, no, in Memphis, he, you know, even after his WWF run, he came there and he worked for quite a while. You know, even though he was, you know, at this point in his late 50s and not mobile at all, he was still a draw. He was still a personality. In Memphis, they would work around that. You know, you had a lot of guys there that were so beloved, they could work well into their later years, and it almost didn't matter what your work was. I mean, people loved and respected you regardless.
And you may not know this, but I've always wondered how in the world, because, I mean, I hadn't thought about Plowboy Frazier in probably since that last run in Southeastern in the early 80s. How in the world did Vince McMahon tap him to come to New York?
Well, I mean, think of it this way. I mean, Jimmy Hart was his manager in Memphis for a long time when he was a heel.
That's true. That's true.
And he also worked with Jim Morris, who became Hillbilly Jim.
Right, when he was
so,
Harley Davidson. Yeah.
Yeah, Harley Davidson, of course. Sure. So what happened was they were giving Hillbilly Jim the big push, and he got injured in a match in San Diego. There was a wet spot on the floor, and he slipped in his kneecap. Got ripped out of its socket. So he was on the shelf for a long time, several months, pretty serious injury. So they wanted to keep him in the headlines. And so they thought, well, we need someone for him to manage. And they figured, well, bring in his uncle. And it just kind of made sense. You know, Stan sort of was a sports entertainer before it was fashionable, you know?
Yeah.
So he fit the criteria perfectly. And of course, they wanted big men, and he's a guy almost the size of Andre. You know, he just walks into a building and he makes an impression. So, it almost didn't matter that he couldn't do too much out there. It was just this big monster coming out, and yeah, he fit perfectly. But of course, he couldn't work very well, so they had to bring in someone who could do more of the mechanics, and then they brought in Lanny Keene, who was Cousin Junior. Cousin Junior didn't last too long. Then they brought in Cousin Luke.
Gene Lewis, yeah.
So, yeah, Gene Lewis, exactly. And, of course, Gene Lewis worked that gimmick for the rest of his life. You know, it was such a strong gimmick for him. But No, it was it was just that window of time was just perfect for him to come in, and it just made sense.
And I imagine that compared to a lot of the other places that he was going to work towards the end of his career, this was a good payday for him.
Oh, this was a great payday for him. He was making some serious money. But, you know, the problem was when he came in, he was, you know, he was 54 years old. You know, that would be difficult for anybody who's been working in wrestling for years, but especially when you're 450 pounds, nearing 7 feet tall. You know, he had a lot of health issues, and you probably know the travel schedule that they held all of the boys to was insane. It was completely nonsensical. They wouldn't go from San Francisco to San Diego and then to Phoenix, Arizona. They would go from San Francisco to Peoria, Illinois, you know, and then they would go to Portland, Oregon. And it's just the guys were getting worn out, you know, even the young guys. But someone like Stan Frazier, it really took a toll on him.
I can't imagine that. Bobby, do you remember Jerry when you guys were still fans? Do you remember him working here in Georgia? I know he did under various guises.
He was
Ed Younger here too, and then he was Big Tex under Mask, and then he was the Convict.
Even before that,
somewhere
he was the Country Plowboy originally.
Yeah.
I can remember introducing him in 79 in Atlanta. You know, he was brought over from Alabama, and he was in here twice, and but during that period of the Georgia Championship Wrestling, I saw him twice here, you know, two different times. And Robert Fuller brought him in.
Yeah, I know Robert Fuller with the deal with the Freebirds.
Brought him in the last time. And so he was the kind of guy, in my opinion, that here he made a big pop. You know, when he would come in, particularly if he was used correctly, but he wore out fairly quickly also. And,
exactly. Well, it's like Abdullah the Butcher. I mean, how long can you keep him in an area? He gets stale really quick, and everybody knew it. So Haystack Calhoun, it's the same bit. And Andre, they kept him on the road all the time because the gimmick wears out. It doesn't matter how talented you are, you know. If you're a gimmick, you're a gimmick.
There's only a certain type of match they can work, and there's only a certain type of guy they can work with. And,
exactly.
To make it entertaining for the audience. And, you play them around the circuit and two or three times, and then it's time for them to move on. But it did seem that, to me, Alabama and, to a greater extent, Tennessee was a kind of homestead place for him to work.
Well, I think it's just because he became so beloved as a personality. People, after a while, just accept you for what you are. Well, it's like Giant Baba, you know. He was so popular everywhere that he went. He couldn't wrestle like he used to, so he started doing comedy matches. But people still wanted to see him no matter what. It just became part of the tradition. And, of course, Giant Baba was so well-respected. Not saying that Stan was in the same category, but it's just one of those things people just – they love you so much. It's like Jimmy Valiant. Will he ever retire?
I think Jimmy's just going to skinny away.
Oh.
He's got to be down to about 98 pounds by now.
Oh, I know. I saw some footage of him recently. But you know what? People still love him, and they will suspend their disbelief for that moment because it's Jimmy Valiant.
Another one is Bob Armstrong.
Look at that. I mean, it's, you know, even when Terry Funk comes back to the ring, and who knows, he probably will again, you know, it's just – people want that, and they accept it, and it's just it's just one of those things in wrestling that you can't quite explain, but it's real, you know. Yeah, I think, you know, with you know, well, Percy told me that he was booking some of the smaller towns for World Class. It was about 89-90, and he brought in, you know, Stan was Uncle Elmer for him. And he said that it didn't matter that, you know, he was big and he couldn't do too much in a match. People saw him. They remembered him. The memories flooded back, and that's what it meant to them. It's like seeing an old friend again, and that's all that mattered. Yeah, it's,
well, I imagine up in New York, he had a whole new clientele for his wristwatches.
yeah, I talked to many of the boys, and they all tell me the same thing. I mean, I can't think of anyone who you know made it into the big time and still did things like that. He couldn't change his ways, and you know, it wasn't that people were angry at him, but it's sort of quaint. He was something from an older generation that still
yep.
hung on, you know. And he was an old fashioned con artist. I mean, he really was. You know, the way you know these watches that he would sell to the guys, these Rolex watches for $20. I mean, come on. But you know, he would do so many things that that they would have done back in the early days. But he couldn't change his stripes, you know. But instead of that being something that made people angry, they found it kind of endearing and charming.
When can we possibly look for the book to you know come to full fruition?
Well, I'm trying to get it done within the next year. Within the span of a year. So it started out. I was doing a book with Stan's widow, Joyce. Now, she's the one that married, you know, Uncle Elmer on the Saturday night's main event. So she wanted her memories of their life together and his career to be commemorated somehow. So we were working on that for a while, and it was actually in the form of a cookbook. Because, you know, obviously a man that big needs to eat a lot.
I would think so.
Yeah, so I got some of the recipes that she made, some of her family, the family recipes that were passed on down to her. But Joyce passed away as we were working on the book. I shelved it for a long time, but I want to take what we started and expand on that. But I'll use that sort of as the core of it all. I don't think there's been a biography like that, at least for a wrestler. But there's still a lot of the guys around who remember him, and I want to get them all involved. You know, everybody who knew him or worked with him has a strong reaction. Some are negative, some are positive. I want to have all of that combined. It sort of makes up the entire picture of who he was. So, yeah, like I said, hopefully in the span of a year, I hope to get this all done. But it's going to be some work. Go ahead.
Before Joyce passed away, was she able to put you in touch with any of his family members or anything? Because I know absolutely nothing about his background.
I have just a little bit of contact with the family. It's been a while. We started talking a little bit again recently. I have family photos. I have a lot of connections here and there, but other than that, I mean, a lot of people have moved around a lot. So, yeah, I mean, I, you know, even after all of these years, I don't even know who trained him for wrestling. I have no clue. I know he started in 1960, so that means that he wrestled for over 30 years, which is pretty amazing considering most big men. You're lucky to have a 10-year career. But that's another mystery I'd like to find out.
I don't know where he started or anything, because like I said, he didn't pop up on my radar the first time I saw him was in 1971, but he'd been in and out of the Gulf Coast area as I've you know, done research on that territory, and I've seen results of him in, like I said, places like Omaha, and of course he was a convict and
sure.
in California and all that stuff.
Yeah, the earliest result that I've seen is from 1961, and he was working for Gunkel at the time. So that was, you know, but it's amazing to see him. It's this young, almost handsome, trim, and he had his teeth and everything, you know. It's amazing to see. But they wanted to really push him, and you know, from the very beginning, they had him in the overalls, cut like haystack, so he was going to be, you know, a haystack like gimmick. But you know, when he was younger, as I understand it from people that I've talked to, he was a lot more physically capable. But, you know, years went on, injuries came along, and he became, you know, the big man that we knew later on. But I can't imagine him in a foxhole, you know, during the Korean War. How could you
think? Yeah, I was going to say, he was an easy target, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody else just kind of hid behind him. Because you think about
right.
it, when he came along, you know, in the 60s, there was nobody like him. I mean, Baba,
oh, sure.
you know, but even Baba was, is, you know, not 7 feet tall like they built him. But, you know, you had guys like Donnelly O'Jonathan, who everybody considered
yeah.
a giant, and he was only 6'5", 6'6".
Right.
And, of course, this was,
well,
you know, many years before Andre. But and then you had the guys in the – even going back in the 50s, you had guys like Max Palmer, who was a legit 7'7", but that guy was horrible.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
if you've ever seen video of him,
Lee.
He was
– yeah.
Sky High Lee, I think, was probably not much taller than 6'5", you know.
Oh, really? Okay.
He was not all – you know. And he had and I know I'm going to say it wrong, but the acromegaly or whatever it's called, the same thing.
Yeah,
the same thing Pak Song had, that Baba had, you know, that deformed
mm-hmm.
big chest, skinny arms, skinny legs.
Yep.
But I mean, yeah, you had heavy guys, you know, like Happy Humphrey, and even before there was a Farmer Humphrey before Happy Humphrey back in the 50s. And you had Man Mountain Dean and Martin
sure.
Blimp Levy and people like that. Big men, you know, heavy guys were fairly common in the business, especially, you know, if Jack Pfeffer had anything to do with them. But,
of course.
You know, somebody stand size being, because he was pretty close to 7 feet, if he wasn't at 7 feet. And the only other person I can think of from that era that was even near that was Grizzly Smith.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And was he 6'9"?
Yeah, well, Grizzly, because I've got a picture of me and Grizzly together, and I'm 6'5", and he's
yeah.
a good 6 inches taller than me.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, he was a huge man. Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, then, of course, you had Ernie Ladd. Of course, he was, 6'9"?
He
huge
was 6'9",
guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Stan, some people, his wife swore up and down that he was 7'1". I've heard it from most sources that he was 6'10", but of course it's so hard to say nowadays. I've seen pictures of Stan standing next to Hillbilly Jim, who's 6'5". I'm 6'2", and Hillbilly is much bigger than me, and Stan is dwarfs Hillbilly Jim, so I mean, I'd say 6'10" is about right.
Yeah, yeah, I would think that's about right.
Pretty close. It's interesting. One of the things that you know, when Andre consolidated his power, there were certain guys, you probably know this, that Andre didn't like, and if you were on Andre's bad side, you know, there was no way you would change his mind. Stan was on his bad side. And I don't know if that's because he felt threatened by having another giant around him or not, but he never wrestled him one-on-one that I know of. I mean, that sounds like it would be a dream match, at least in the early 70s. But I know he worked in a tag team match against Andre. In the WWF, when you know they had the wedding of Uncle Elmer, and they really wanted to push it big, Hulk Hogan was there in the wedding party, and they also had Andre. And Andre did not want to be a part of that. And apparently, they had to pay him main event money in order to just stand there and do nothing because he didn't want to be seen. He didn't want to be seen next to another big man to sort of take away from his gimmick. It's kind of interesting, you know?
Yeah, it is strange.
But, you know, they went to great lengths to protect Andre to make him look like he was the biggest man in wrestling, and that was the one time that I can think of where they were willing to sacrifice that. But, no, he would badmouth Stan all the time in the locker room. And this is from many of the boys that I've talked to over the years. And all I can think of is just the fact that he didn't want another big man to sort of encroach his territory. All I can think of.
Yeah, that's the only thing that would make sense. Unless he bought a bad watch from him. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think Andre had enough to buy a good watch.
I imagine so. Yeah, I can't think of anywhere that they were even on the same card together. I mean, you would think they would have crossed paths somewhere, even before the WWF, that they would have crossed paths sometime in the 70s.
Yeah, I saw one. There was one match. It was Andre was teaming. I think it was a six-man tag. Andre was teaming with Ron Mikalajczyk, so this was Memphis. I forget who the third partner was. Let's just say it was Tommy Rich. So it was Andre and so that team, and then it was Stan with Jerry Lawler and Ernie Ladd. So it was called the Battle of the Giants. That's the only one that I'm definitely sure of. That's documented. And then there was a tag team match in the WWF where Andre and Uncle Elmer teamed. I think it was King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd. But it's the only two that I know of over the years. It's amazing. Because you definitely could have made money with
it. He had a bit of a history with Ernie Ladd because he, both in Louisiana and in Mobile, they never wrestled in the same match, but they were referees in the same match with Jack and Frank Dalton working against Danny Little Bear and Kelly in Louisiana, and then it was the Daltons against the Fields brothers in Mobile, and they've had Ernie as a referee, and then the Daltons had Big Ed Younger is their referee, which was Tiny.
So funny.
So it was odd. I don't know how they held the ring up.
they could have had a match. I don't think it would have been beautiful. well, they wanted to build up to matches between in Omaha. So this would have been, I guess he was Plowboy Frazier up there and Tex McKenzie. Now, could you imagine how bad that match would have been?
Yeah.
Only thing would have made that worse is put Ox Baker and Moose Cholock in there.
Oh, man. Yeah, that would have been pretty ugly. But you know, and all of these guys too. I mean, you mentioned Ox, you mentioned Moose. I mean, but what great personalities they were, you know. And
oh yeah.
And all of these guys, it was an extension of who they really were. That doesn't exist in wrestling anymore. Guys are not allowed to develop
their own
characters.
Well, yeah, because guys that size are almost commonplace now. That's what people expect a wrestler to look like. I mean, especially a territory like the Mobile territory, which was mainly junior heavyweights. Mm-hmm. When Jerry came in there, Jerry was, what are you, 6'3", 6'4", Jerry?
Three.
About 230, something like that. He was a giant compared to guys like Ken Lucas at 5'8", 5'9".
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But back in the 60s, and like going back to what I was saying about Ernie and Stan together, just having somebody that size, they didn't even have to do anything. Just have them on the card. They'd draw a crowd.
Of course.
You know, because they were such an anomaly, because there just was not guys that big back then.
Well, and Les Thatcher told me once, you know, that he got stuck with Tiny for a long time, and you know, Les went out there and he worked the whole match basically. He would tag Tiny in. Tiny would do a punch, maybe the leg drop, and that's all that was necessary. That's all people expected out of him. But you know, it's just funny to think, you know, that was what it was back then. You know, it was such a novelty. People were just excited for just that little something different. You know, they didn't expect the world out of you, but just, you know, just the visual spectacle.
You know, and as pro wrestling continued to develop from the 30s and 40s into the 50s and 60s, you know, being a work, as you said, the fans expected to see guys do certain things.
Right.
And they weren't going to, particularly the tag match, was not going to be an extended long match between, you know, two, let's say, extensively trained wrestlers. There were going to be guys that, like we've seen here, that and talking about that were gimmick wrestlers, and
absolutely,
the fans would see what they'd want. The fans would see what they would want to see, and then, you know, the guy'd tag out. It's like you'd see why stay there and try to do it again. You know, freshen it up with another guy, and then come back a little later and maybe for the finish and do the same thing over again. But I don't think anybody was looking for Stan Frazier to do an extended match. They were looking for him to do whatever
the main babyface tag team partner stays in trouble and then finally tags out Stan. He comes and cleans house and they go home. Something
right.
I've always wondered, Bobby, you may know this since you were working in the office at the time when Fuller brought him in. It seemed like he was here, you know, and they had the thing going with the Freebirds, and it was pretty hot. And then all of a sudden, you know, they did an injury angle, and Tiny was gone, and they replaced him with Ted DiBiase. What was there a reason behind his stay cut short, or do you know?
Bottom line, he didn't get over.
Yeah.
You know, the thing here, when he had the last run here, I know this is off the subject. I probably shouldn't say this, but when you said he came in through a punch and a leg drop, I thought we had switched to a Hulk Hogan match. I mean, think about it. It's the same thing. It was the same thing. But the thing with Stan here, Robert brought him in. He was immediately on top. Robert was booking. And Robert had done this in Southeastern. He had done it in Knoxville. It had got over. And I'm not saying Georgia fans are any different than any fans anywhere else in the world, but I think Jerry will agree with me. This was a wrestling territory.
Sure.
They expected guys to be able to go from the get-go. The fans were given that week after week after week after week, whether they were big guys, little guys, medium-sized guys. Everybody that came in here could wrestle, could go, could do different things. And when you'd bring a guy like Frazier in, it was exactly the same as Haystacks. I love Haystacks. Mm-hmm. I love to talk to him. I love to be in the dressing room with him. He was a great guy. But you could only use Haystacks for 2 weeks. He could make the loop twice. That's all you can do with him. And that was exactly what was the thing with Stan. And they tried to run programs with Stan where it was drawing money, doing angles, and it just didn't work. And that's the reason they had to, replacing Stan with Ted DiBiase, I mean, you look at the difference in the quality of the matches you got.
Oh, of course.
That was it.
Well,
a major
upgrade.
When Robert Fuller was done, Stan was done. You know, I think Fuller knew that his days were numbered there, and Stan was an easy guy to bring in here to kind of finish things up with. And, you know, he was on his way out. Stan came in for a couple of weeks, and he, like you said, he was gone. That was, the new booker was looking to not only to freshen things up, but as Bobby said, have somebody that was going to be able to carry main events. And at that point in late 79, Stan wasn't going to be able to do it.
Well, another thing, too, and this is in defense of Robert Fuller, and I've said this on here many times, Robert had great success booking in Knoxville. He had good success booking in Mobile for his brother down there in Pensacola. Booking Atlanta was a totally different animal.
Yep.
It was a totally – it was unique to anything in the industry at the time because of the TV and because of the audience that you had. And it just – you know, it took a very special person to do it. And it took a personality to do it that, you know, maybe thought outside the box a little. So it was it just that whole line of that had been successful in other places, the people here in Atlanta just did not buy it.
So that's why. So you're telling me that's why they split me and the McGuire twins up.
Well, no, they couldn't find anybody to beat you guys, so they had to, you know.
That's right. They wouldn't have believed it was going to, you know, somebody was going to be.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, they brought Stan into certain areas, but never for a length of time. Well, he worked for Eddie Graham, you know, talk about a wrestling area, you know, where people expect a certain level of excellence. They were wise to bring him in for maybe one, two shots and then leave it at that. But to even conceive of doing a program with him in a territory known for strong workers, it's kind of absurd. I think they probably did the most that they could, but you know, that was it. You know, it was
the only time in Mobile that I remember him having any kind of extended program was in 68 when he was in as the convict. He had probably 2 weeks, 2-3 weeks worth of matches with Dr. Jerry Graham, who was, you know, by that time, you know, 450 pounds himself.
Right.
But there again, somebody that size, that was the draw, was just two great big men getting in there together, you know.
Of course.
It didn't matter to the fans that they couldn't do anything. It's just that the fact that, you know, such a difference from normal people, those two big men.
Well, and Dr. Jerry Graham, what a great talker he was. I mean, what a great personality. I mean, he could talk anybody in the building for one or two matches, but once you saw what he could deliver at that point, you know, that was it. But
you know, that was since Mobile didn't have anybody near Jerry Graham's size when because he had been in and out of that territory going back as far as 1954. But, in fact, he was Gulf Coast champion in 1960 or 61. But he came back in 68, and he was just so big that it didn't make sense. So what they did is they put Bill Bowman and Joe Turner with him and put masks on him and, you know, called them the interns. And and he was successful doing that because, like you said, he could talk. And Bill Bowman used to say Jerry Graham could walk into a room and never open his mouth and people hated him.
Yep.
Just the way he carried himself. And so, you know, they were using Stan as a special, you know, special referee or something because of his size when he was the convict. And that led to, of course, you know, him getting into it with the interns and with Jerry Graham, and it led to that whole thing. And then they had a hair versus mask match, I think, is what that finally ended him his run as the convict. He had to unmask.
Yeah.
And then they did a loser leaves town after that, and of course Stan lost, and he was gone. But but that's the only extended program I can remember him even having in Mobile, that territory, because like I said before, he would come in for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks as a you know, a troubleshooter or whatever you want to call it. He would come in and team with the top babyface against the top heel tag team or whatever, and you know, the fans would get what they wanted, and the blow off, he'd beat whoever, and then he'd be gone again. Of course, I think I don't know if he worked another job or anything like that other than being a bouncer at the Red Barn on the state line. I'm sure he did something else over.
Oh, he had a shoe store for many years, Frazier's Shoes, and he would advertise that on local wrestling, and of course, you know, just his general business dealings that he did, he was able to sustain himself that way. But it was always sort of like, you know, the best he could do with what he had. He was never truly proficient in anything.
Did he, Jay West here, did he actually do anything with the shoe business, or was it mostly just putting his name on it?
No, he actually had a shoe store. Percy told me about it. He took me to the spot where it was, and it was right there in Pascagoula. In fact, I have a canceled check with a Fraser's shoes stamp on it, so it was legit. I can't remember for the life of me the exact location, but of course Percy's not here to show me anymore. But yeah, it was legit. He did have a shoe store, and he was a promoter as well. He promoted his own matches here and there. You know, he wasn't the most successful promoter, but he did all right. I've heard rumors for years, and I got to talk to Coco about it. Apparently, he trained Coco Beware.
Well, that's where Coco learned that great drop kick from Stan.
Of course. Makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, but that's what I've been told. So I need to, you know, this is part of my journey to sort of dig things up. Because he's a guy that people know and have talked about, but they sort of put their memories to the side. And that's why I think a book would be so fascinating. Well, another thing,
oh, I
too,
agree, because, I mean, like I said, yeah. As much as I've, you know, researched the Gulf Coast Territory and him in and out of there, I know nothing about his background other than the fact he was from Pascagoula. And the only reason I know that is because they called him the Pascagoula Plowboy.
Of course, yeah. Well, he just, I think he was resigned to the fact that he was going to be traveling all of his life, like Haystack or like Abdullah. It's just, that's the life of that kind of worker, you know.
Yeah.
So it is really hard to pin down any facts on them because they're just all over the place. And, of course, they make things up and they lie. And, of course, like all the boys did back then to sort of create their aura. But the other problem that I faced over the years is because I was a fan, some of the boys didn't want to tell me anything negative about him. So... And I, you know, Bob Kelly and Bill Bowman, they were the same way, you know. They said, well, we don't want to say anything negative about him. I said, I know all the negative things. You don't have to hide it. But unfortunately, the stories went with them. And I tried for years to get the stories out of them, but they wouldn't say it. So, I don't know.
Did it change you seeing as you heard the bad stuff? I mean, did it make you say, well, you know, maybe I don't want to do the book, or I'm not interested in doing the book as I thought I would be.
Honestly, it just makes him a more fascinating character. You know, everything that I've heard about him is so unique and so extreme. And, you know, he's more akin to like an old-time vaudevillian than a professional wrestler in many ways. You know, just always looking for a booking, always looking for... another dollar, any way that he could get it, you know, and he's that way, you know. Henny Youngman, towards the end of his life, apparently for many years, he would get signed for a gig. He would play, let's say, a bar mitzvah. You know, he wasn't working the big arenas anymore, but he would be performing for, let's say, 150 people at a Holiday Inn. He would go in the lobby, and he would start soliciting work right after a gig, and he'd say, look, I'll take anything you got, you know, $50, $100, I'll perform for you and your wife tonight, you know. And it seems to me that Stan Fraser was exactly that kind of guy, you know. And really, that's old-time performers had to be resourceful just to survive, you know, living
right
from gig to gig. You know, he was lucky to have the protection of Memphis. I mean, you know, that was a godsend for him. But even there, he could only last for so long, and then they had to freshen things up a bit. But I think all of the things that I've heard about him, negative and positive, just make up such a fascinating story. I mean, it just makes it more intriguing for me. And I think once people start learning about him more. Well, they might not enjoy his matches more, but they'll certainly enjoy or appreciate him more for what he brought to wrestling.
You know, it's funny you say Memphis as his haven. The last time I saw him, in 1985. I went with Ann Gunkel, and Jerry was there that night. We went to we did film some matches at the Mid-South Coliseum, sort of a joint venture between Ann and Jerry Jarrett to pitch a thing to ESPN. And Stan was in the dressing room that night, and he was selling watches and talking trash, and you know, but that was the last time I saw him.
So
he wasn't on the card. He wasn't working. He was just there.
Yeah. Well, he's probably just letting people know, hey, I'm still here. You know, give me a booking.
Yeah.
So.
I've got a photo that has been an absolute mystery to me. It's with Stan, but he's not in his hillbilly gimmick. He's wearing, you know, a red outfit, red tights, red bodysuit type thing. And he's with Armand Hussein and Bob Boyer, but Bob Boyer's in his Bobby Bold Eagle gimmick. And I've had that picture for 20 years, and I've racked my brain where that could have been taken. Because the three of them all worked in Mobile, but Bob Boyer never did the Bold Eagle gimmick there. The only place I know he did that was for Bruiser. But Armand Hussein, as far as I know, never worked for Bruiser.
Okay.
The only thing I can think of is that, you know, they would have passed somewhere. You know, I don't know. I can't think of anywhere where they would have all been there at the same time to have that photo made.
I have a picture of Stan with Armand Hussein and why am I blanking on his name right now? The governor who ended up getting shot.
George Wallace,
there you go. Thank you.
Yeah, I've seen that picture. Now, that was taken when they were – I can tell you exactly when that was taken. That one was taken in 1972 or 73. 73 was when that was made because they were both in the Mobile area at that time.
I know Stan worked up for Dean Silverstone, like Armand Hussein did as well, but I don't know if Bob Boyer went up there. Again, it's one of those things. I mean, he went to so many places, did so many things, and it could have conceivably been his own promotion as well.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking that too.
Because he's wearing a title belt in that picture, if I'm not mistaken. And I think somebody told me it was the Mississippi heavyweight title. But that wouldn't
Well, he had his own super heavyweight title that he carried around with him for a long time.
That's right.
In fact, I don't remember what year, I want to say it was 85, 86, 87, somewhere in there, when Rip Tyler had the WOW promotion out of Pensacola, Stan worked for him a couple of times and defended that super heavyweight title.
He would also defend that title in Memphis against Jerry Blackwell. They had Fred Ottman was in there at the time. Was he Big Bubba at the time?
Yeah, I think he was Big Bubba.
Yeah, and then there was a guy named Goliath as well. So, he did defend that against a few of the Giants, but that was always his that he carried along with him. But, it's a mystery for me, even after all of these years, after all of my research and studies and so forth. I mean, it's an ongoing mystery, but again, that's what makes them so fascinating. You know, there are books about guys that were really prominent and beloved, where the material is so easy to find, but I don't know, this is a great challenge for me. Another story that I don't know if you've ever heard, and I really don't believe it holds any water, but a lot of people have told me that Stan was in that famous Bigfoot footage from the late 1960s.
I tell you where that came from. That came from him. That was a story he used to tell the boys. That was me. That was me. He claimed that some guy paid him. And you know, I don't know. I've heard somebody has debunked that it actually was a guy in a suit, but it wasn't Stan.
Okay.
But that story originated with him himself.
Next time I see that film clip, I'll have to look at it closer.
Well, because for a while he went as Bigfoot Frazier, and this was he was supposed to be in a movie called Capture of the Bigfoot. He was signed for it, and was supposed to be in it, but he showed up, and the costume that they gave him made him he was in so much pain in that costume. The guy who designed it had never done a costume before, you know, that needed to be used for motion pictures. So it caused a lot of health issues for him, and he had to pull out of the movie. But he wrote on that as well. So that's so funny. Yeah. But again, I mean, all of these things are so absurd. I mean, how could they not make up a fascinating book, you know?
Unbelievable.
Oh boy. Yeah, but it's a shame that you know, there are so many guys from wrestling that you have all met over the years that, you know, in 10, 15 years time, I mean, no one's going to remember. So thank goodness for the internet. Thank goodness for the historians out there who care to take the time to tell the stories that really, you know, it's like if to know where you're going, you got to know where you've been. And the history of wrestling is so rich and so interesting and diverse. I mean, it's worth documenting on every level.
Sure. Because not only are the guys from that era gone, but many of the historians that have that information are starting to leave us too. So, as Mike mentioned one earlier this evening, so, you know, the information has got to be put down, and it's got to be there for future reference. You know, when somebody says, oh, I saw this super wrestler on WWE, and you know, it's the old story. Oh, you think that's a wrestler, huh? Let me tell you about Flyboy Frazier or something.
Right. Well, and it's just funny, too, how people think they invented the world. You know, young people coming into the industry now, but they're just referring back to old things that have been done time and time again. And of course,
sure,
we who have been around a little bit longer know better. So it's like all the hipsters that are coming out here on the West Coast. I don't know if you have it in other parts of the country, but they're sort of bringing back sort of a renaissance of handcrafted, you know, leather and food. Well, like Portland, Oregon is having a huge renaissance of food and culture, but it's all brought about by the young people. But they're just referring back to all of the things that have been done in the past using old techniques that were, you know, handed down and sort of ignored for a while. But the young people are acting like they invented it all and walking around with an arrogance on their face, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's tied to politics. I think it's tied to politics too a bit. And,
yeah.
You know, so that's what makes them who they are, and they think they're unique, you know.
Of course.
Well, like we've said on this show several times, you know, especially talking about bookers like Tom Ernesto and Leo Garibaldi. Leo Garibaldi carried a notebook full of finishes that he and matches he'd been involved with or matches that he booked. If it was a good finish and it got over 30 years ago, it would get over now.
Yeah.
You know, because nobody's seen it in that length of time. You know.
The dynasty has changed so much.
It has. I mean, it's a different animal entirely. But the things that thrilled people back then can still, you know, thrill people now. It just needs to be modernized somehow.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, my time in watching professional wrestling goes back to the early 50s, but in really becoming a fan, you know, before getting involved in the business as I did in about 75, but between 68 and 74 was the prime time for me to be a fan. But I can, based on having the knowledge that I have from that, look at a match from the early 50s, and, you know, I can say, you know, that's really interesting to look at. It's a little bit different, but it lets me know, you know, where the profession went to, and these two guys that are in there, you know, are putting on a great match. It's different, but it's a great match, and I think that you know, we've got to make sure that the WWE doesn't doesn't take all of his footage. There's some that's still out there with Paul Bosch's widow, I think. And we just got to make sure that these guys, you know, somebody doesn't just take all of his footage so that it's not going to be available for, you know, real wrestling fans to see later on.
Well, it's as valuable as saving silent movies. It really is.
Sure. Yes.
Because that's the history of cinema. It's where everything came from. All of these ideas that we think and all these emotions that we feel when we watch movies, everything started then. You know,
sure.
You see a comedy today and there's echoes of Charlie Chaplin. There's Fatty Arbuckle. There's little touches that go way, way back.
Right.
You have to preserve that.
Yep. You know, seeing Metropolis, the silent movie. I mean, if you're a sci-fi fan, you can't help but see that.
Well, that movie was so influential. You can see that in just about you can see snippets of Metropolis in a whole lot of you know, futuristic type movies that are coming out even now. Just, you know.
Yep.
That movie was so far ahead of its time. It's one of my favorite movies.
Oh,
but Jerry,
it's,
I know it's past
brilliant.
Your bedtime, so
it's getting close, guys.
All right. Well, gentlemen, this has been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
We're certainly glad to have that you were able to get on tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much, guys. I'll let you all have a wonderful evening and look forward to chatting with you again.
Thanks, all right, Kirk. We appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Okay, take care now.
All right.
I'm going to have to cut out in a little while. But Bobby, did you want to talk about going out to Las Vegas, or did you want to save that for next week or something?
Well, no, it's fine. Myself and Randy Corin, who worked in the Atlanta office with me, and Scrappy McGowan and Gene Bennett, who's been on our show several times, we decided to drive this year. So we did 12 states in 11 days, and we just kind of made a little vacation out of it on the trip back. We went to, first of all, I was very honored to get the Charlie Smith Referee Award in Las Vegas this year. As I told them, we have many acquaintances that we come across, but Charlie is not an acquaintance; he's a friend. And for me to get an award with his name on it was a great honor. And the only other person that had ever won it was James Roach, and he's class all the way. So I'm very honored to be included in on that list. But we got through with Cauliflower Alley, and we left, and we went to the Grand Canyon, and we went to a place called Four Corners, and if you ever get a chance to go, it's where Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico, it's where their borders meet. It's the only place in the United States where four states come together in one spot, and it's run by the Navajo Indians. It's on their reservation, and it is a phenomenal. It's out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's in the middle of the desert. But it is a phenomenal place to go and just visit, to just something you can say you've done. We went to Winslow, Arizona, and stood on the corner from the Eagles song "Take It Easy" back in the 70s.
Told me that, and I told him I wondered what any of the four of them would be able to do if a girl in a flatbed Ford actually came by. They wouldn't none of them be able to do anything with her.
No, we couldn't, but we could have dreamed. But they built a statue of Jackson Brown and of Glenn Frey there on a corner in Winslow, and we went by and made some pictures of that, and then we went to Billy the Kid's grave, which was interesting to me. He's buried in a little place called Fort Sumner, New Mexico, and that was kind of an interesting thing. And the last place we stopped in Lubbock, Texas, which was for me. My wife had a half brother she never met, and unfortunately he died when he was 19. And I was able to go by his grave and just pay my respects, and that was kind of a personal thing for me. And then we came back through Oklahoma City by the Murrow Center, where the memorial is built, where they blew that building up, and it was a neat thing. And then we came home, but we had a great time, and they're already talking about wanting to do it again next year and figure out some other places to go see. So We did 40, right at 4,800 miles in 11 days, just a week in the Oklahoma territory for Jerry. But it was we had a fun time. It was a great trip.
Sounds good.
Now if I can get my body back on Georgia time, I'll be in good shape.
Ron Starr, who was it I was talking to? Wasn't Ron Starr. I was talking to somebody else. Oh, the week Stubbs was on the show, Jerry. You weren't with us 2 weeks ago when Jerry Stubbs was on. He's got one of those cushy jobs like government jobs like you where he works like 2 days a week. Of course, you work more, but he's, you know, works in the courthouse like six hours a day, 3 days a week. But he said you to call him and hook him up with him a golf cart down there on Tybee Island so he can ride around down there with you. Did we lose Jerry?
Yes, he's gone.
Yep, he's gone. Okay.
Well,
you
know,
talking,
Jerry ain't giving that gig up, I can tell you right now.
I know that. Oh, I know.
Well, all right,
guys.
I think I've depleted it.
Yeah, we beat everybody in the territory, so
yeah.
Glad to have you back, Jay. And again, happy birthday to the two of you guys. And
thank you so much.
Everything, and we will get together next week. I've got a couple of things lined up. I've got one thing I'm hoping for next week, which I won't announce yet because I don't know for sure. And if that falls through, I've got something else. So. And if it does come through, then something else I have will be for week after next. So we've got some things coming up in the next couple of weeks. It should be interesting. But anyway, this was fun tonight, guys. Kurt's a good guy. I've known Kurt for many, many years, and first time I've ever had an extended conversation with him. But he's a great guy, if nothing else, for immortalizing Charlie Smith in animated form. So
we never even got to talk to him about what he does for a living. He works for Walt Disney World or Walt Disney.
Wow.
And I'm not sure exactly what he does out there, but he's been with them for a number of years. But he's that's got to be interesting in itself.
Sure.
All right, guys. Well, we will get together again next week, and we'll do this one more time.
All righty. Hey,
okay, good night, fellas.
Mike, can you give me a call, please, sir?
I will.
Thank you, sir.
All right,
guys.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.